Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
President Obama calls Pakistan an important ally, key to the success of our fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
The Pakistan people must know, America will remain a strong supporter of Pakistan's security and prosperity long after the guns have fallen silent.
But how do the Pakistanis feel? American diplomats can't get visas, neither can the mechanics who are supposed to repair their helicopters. Pakistanis say Americans are arrogant and meddling, and they don't want more of them in their country. A story of unrequited love in Pakistan on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 17th. And the takeaway for me here, John, is, you know, the relationships between the United States and Pakistan has always been strained, but it's really never mattered as much before right. as it does now.
And probably most of the love is in the U.S. among Pakistani Americans rather than in
right.
Peshawar for U.S. policy. That's for sure. It's let's get right to it, though. It's crunch time at the climate talks in Copenhagen, leading the headlines this morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced that the United States is prepared to join other rich nations in raising $100 billion for developing nations.
The important point for the next 2 days is not to talk about how we would fund money that we haven't yet agreed to fund, but to make the agreement that that is what we're going to do.
Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Peter Thompson of PRI's The World, who's in Copenhagen, says the attention now shifts to China.
People are saying here that it really puts pressure on the Chinese because this money is going to be targeted at the least developed countries, but it's contingent on China moving on the issue of verification and verifying their emissions.
President Obama heads to the conference for the final day of negotiations. A flurry of last-minute legislation on Capitol Hill last night. The House changed the rules to allow the federal government to borrow more money. The Treasury says the national debt now stands at $12.1 trillion. Todd Zwillick will talk about the controversy of that ballooning number in about 20 minutes. Heading overseas, security forces in Yemen are going after Al-Qaeda this morning. They've reportedly raided Al-Qaeda hideouts and training camps, killing 34 suspected militants and arresting 17 others. Yemeni authorities believe they may have foiled a series of suicide bomb attacks.
Meanwhile, in Pakistan, the country's top court struck down an amnesty that had protected the president from corruption charges. Pakistan's president is a key U.S. ally. And our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that parts of the Pakistani military and intelligence services are mounting what American officials describe as a campaign to harass American diplomats. We're joined now by Marvin Weinbaum. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former State Department analyst on Pakistan. Marvin, what are the specific diplomatic issues going on between the U.S. and Pakistan?
Well, the heart of it now is to use our diplomacy as we can to rebuild the trust with both the Pakistan leadership and the public. That's at the moment a low ebb.
Right, but what are these things that are going on that they're talking about in what they call a concerted campaign to harass American diplomats?
Well, it's a reflection of developments over the last, especially over the last couple of years, where they feel that the United States is, honestly, there are many there who feel the United States really wishes to have Pakistan broken up. And that kind of feeling here poisons the atmosphere between us.
Okay, stay with us. Marvin Weinbaum will be back with you in just a moment.
One of the most wanted figures in Mexico's drug war, the boss of bosses, he was called, Arturo Beltran Leyla. His cartel was responsible for much of the bloodshed across Mexico, was killed, reportedly, in a shootout with the Mexican Navy. Asian markets down this morning. European indices down as well. Wall Street futures also down. The Dow will open at 10,441. The S&P gets underway at 1,109, and the NASDAQ opens at 2206.
Coming up, we're going to talk about technology as we do every Thursday, and we're going to tell you how to build a better online password later this hour. Also, what is the cost of higher education? For some, it's twice as much as you might think. Our series Life in Fine Print continues with a look at student loans. What's your story? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more on the strained relations between the U.S. and Pakistan. Good morning. The New York Times reports today that attitudes towards Americans in Pakistan, particularly diplomats, have become so hostile, they describe it as a concerted effort at harassment. And here to talk about that is Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former State Department analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Shujaat Nawaz, director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council and the author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Armory, and the Wars Within. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
In the New York Times article, they describe incidents where American diplomats complain that, A, the 135 or so of them can't get their visas renewed. Their cars are being searched at checkpoints. They can't get visas for even the mechanics who are supposed to fix the helicopters that the United States has on loan. I mean, they're talking about the specific incidents, which in and of themselves may not sound like a big deal. But Marvin, together, they call this, a concerted effort to harass Americans.
Well, it's got to be seen in the context of what has become a poisonous atmosphere in not just leaders having difficulty with the United States, but the public. And they're reflecting that attitude here. And some of it is seen as a payback also because they claim that the Pakistanis are having difficulty getting visas to coming to the United States.
Shujaat, there has never been a cozy relationship between the United States and Pakistan. They've long had a lot of anti-American sentiment there. What is different here?
Well, it's not very different. We've always had a roller coaster relationship. The United States has generally had a relationship with the leadership in Pakistan, whether it's an individual or an institution or a group. And they've not tried hard to maintain a relationship with the people of Pakistan. This is really what's fueling the current actions inside Pakistan. At the lower end of the spectrum, the police as well as the security agencies that are being accused of these actions by the unnamed spokesman for the U.S. Embassy, it's quite clear that there is a fair amount of resentment about the U.S. presence in the country, as well as Marvin said, stories that abound of how Pakistani officials, including the military, have been refused visas for coming to the United States.
But Marvin talked about this being something that's been going on for a couple years, and as you said, this is kind of a long-standing strained relationship. And I'm wondering what's calling attention to it now. Is it because the United States wants to become more involved in order to stage strikes against al-Qaeda and Taliban militants? Is it because of the $7.5 billion five-year aid plan that's been promised from Washington to Pakistan? Marvin, what's bringing this issue to the front now?
Well, there are a number of things. Of course, the drone attacks really began the acuteness of this a few years ago, and those have really created much of this atmosphere. But it had been there for a long time. The sense that Pakistanis have always felt that the United States was not a reliable partner, and what we're seeing now is events that include the recent announcement of additional forces in Afghanistan, which are seen by Pakistanis as somehow not being in their interest.
Marvin, let's explore that for a second. You raised this issue at the top of the hour, which really stood out in my mind, the idea that Pakistanis believe the Americans want Pakistan to break up in some sense. I mean, reading the sort of Obama and George W. Bush's statements, that couldn't be farther from U.S. policy, it would seem. Do Pakistanis worry that they're about to break up and that the presence of U.S. troops might aid that?
Well, I think there is what once was a conspiracy theory and now has become a large measure of consensus in the country that the United States, in collusion with India and perhaps others, really wishes to see Pakistan weakened. And behind that is the idea that the United States is determined to somehow get its control of Pakistan's nuclear weapons.
Shuja, to explain to me that the complaint about the Pakistanis wanting more aid on one hand and then the other hand wanting the Americans to leave. I mean, obviously, the Americans are hoping to ramp up their efforts in Pakistan and Afghanistan, not just in terms of drone strikes, but they're also hoping to bring in 300 additional diplomats over the next couple of years as well. Is the sort of conflicting messages coming out of the Pakistani government because one hand doesn't know what the other is doing, or is it there's really a conflict within the Pakistani government itself?
I think there are paradoxes throughout this relationship on both sides. The United States obviously does want Pakistan under some measure of control, but it also relies on a very stable and strong Pakistan in order to support the effort in Afghanistan. On the Pakistani side, they do need economic assistance, but they also are very scared of what Marvin called, the U.S. presence and influence within the country. And the history of the relationship has been such that the United States has tended to speak about the people of Pakistan, but actually only interact with autocrats when there was a need. And then the relationship would atrophy as soon as the U.S. had satisfied its strategic interests in the region. That's what's haunting the relationship, and my fear is that if both sides are not careful with their rhetoric, this may be a train wreck in the making.
Marvin, you know, this could become more complicated because of a decision from the Supreme Court in Pakistan, which has denied amnesty to the President Asif Ali Zardari, who's a strong U.S. ally in the region. If Zardari is ousted, perhaps, through this because of the Supreme Court case, what happens with the relationship between the Pakistan government and the United States?
We've had President Zardari, in a sense, is our point man in Pakistan. He's carried to the extent that any political leader there has been willing to step forward and champion the United States, although even he has had to back off that. Without him there, we believe that we can work with the democratic institutions, and there's a great deal of effort in recent months here to express the fact that although we still value Zardari, that we can work with the Prime Minister. And, of course, we work regularly with the Pakistan military. Mm-hmm. So that it does represent a setback for us, but what we have to be very careful of is that we don't repeat what we had just a few years ago, where we were so locked together with President Musharraf that as he went down, our own relationship with Pakistan also suffered, and we were held responsible, in a sense, for keeping him in power when, in fact, he was transitioning out of power.
Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former State Department analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Also, Shuja Nawaz, director of the South Asia Program at the Atlantic Council. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the news headlines.
In Copenhagen, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced this morning that the United States is prepared to help raise $100 billion a year to help developing countries cope with climate change.
We expect this funding will come from a wide variety of sources, public and private, bilateral and multilateral, including alternative sources of finance.
The money is contingent, however, on China verifying its emissions. Tonight, President Obama heads to the conference to try to resolve that issue. NATO has failed to gain any commitment from Russia to offer more help in Afghanistan. NATO had asked for Russia to provide helicopters and to train the Afghan Air Force.
Back at home, President Obama says if no action is taken on health care reform, the government will go bankrupt because Medicare and Medicaid are on what he calls an unsustainable path. The president was speaking on ABC. Finally, Israel has announced plans to boost the low number of people prepared to donate their organs. It's become the first country to give donors a legal right to priority treatment if they themselves need an organ transplant. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, America's in debt, and Congress just passed a bill that allows the government to borrow even more.
In case people haven't noticed, Titanic is sinking.
That's Dana Rohrabach, who went on to say that we need to draw a line in the sand. We're going to talk more about mixed metaphors with Todd Zwillick in just a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for some quick takeouts on news stories we're following this week. And we're joined first by Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So this is kind of a ritual that happens every year and a half to 2 years, right? They have to up the debt limit in Capitol Hill. But this year it took on increased importance, this particular vote.
Yeah, that's right. The debt limit, the amount of money that the federal government is allowed to borrow is actually set by law, and you can't exceed it. So, you know, we're in the red. We have been for years. Everybody knows that. So everything from Social Security checks to any other money, bonds, any other money the government sends out has to be underneath the debt limit. Well, the debt limit is about to be reached in the next couple of days, and Congress has to raise it. The problem is that the federal debt is already a staggering, get ready for this, Celeste, $12 trillion. That's the federal debt. So a Democratic Congress that needs to increase it, you can imagine the political difficulty in this climate of deficit spending and huge spending in the government, what it takes to raise the debt limit when it's already $12 trillion. So they had a vote on it last night. It barely passed, even though they only raised it a mere $300 billion. Just a tick, just $300 billion.
I mean, the Democrats are in control of Congress right now, but it, you know, this is equally shared on both sides of the aisle.
Well, it is. And Republican Congresses have raised the debt limit over and over again, too. And as you mentioned, it is a bit of a ritual. I mean, the federal debt hasn't gone down, I don't think ever, really. So both sides have done this. But the Democrats are the ones who are staring a really difficult election in 2010 in the face. And they already know that. So having to vote to increase the debt limit, even though they have to do it, they have no choice, is a really tough vote. Now, last night, they voted only to increase it $300 billion, which only gets them to February, probably. And it only it passed with exactly 218 votes, the bare minimum. They had to scrape and scrap for every last vote just to get a little tiny increase in the debt limit passed. I call $300 billion little and tiny. And it means, Celeste, that they're going to have to do it again. So they're going to have to vote on this not once but twice. And you can imagine the 30-second ads that Republicans are going to like to run in November.
Everyone's tuned to C-SPAN recording the video.
Right. Oh, yeah. You can imagine the ads. You know, Congressman John Hockenberry voted to increase the debt twice.
John's
you know, those ads have already been written.
Right. And there is at least one person making apocryphal statements about this.
In case people haven't noticed, Titanic is sinking, and maybe we don't want to look out the portholes and understand that our country is trillions of dollars more in debt now than it was 12 months ago. That has got to stop, or it's going to destroy our country.
I assume we're going to be hearing more of that yet.
Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California giving a preview of what the message is going to be against Democrats on this.
Oh, okay. Quickly, we had an incident between Chuck Schumer, famously designing the Passenger's Bill of Rights on airplanes, but he had an incident with an attendant.
Yeah, Chuck Schumer was asked, his office has acknowledged, he was on a U.S. Airways shuttle flight between Washington and New York the other night with the other senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, and was told, as many of us have been, by the flight attendant to please turn off his cell phone so that they could push back. He wanted to finish a call. She said no, and when she walked away, he muttered something under his breath that wasn't very nice that made news. I won't repeat it on the air, but it was the B word.
The B word. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent.
Ouch. So our last takeout this morning comes from you, listener, as we talked with Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. And for years, the Department of Transportation was focused mostly on the nation's highway system, he said. But under the Obama administration, the focus, he says, is shifting to trains now. High-speed rail for travel and light rail for commuters. We heard from Will in Massachusetts.
It's ironic that commentators use the interstate highway system as a model for a high-speed rail system project. The highway system was the primary cause of the demise of our rail system in the 50s and 60s.
Very good point, Will. You can reach us like he did at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The secretary, though, was making the point that they built the system
overall, right.
in a record amount of time, and if we could do that, maybe we could do the transit system.
Exactly.
But Will does make a good point.
But some skepticism from you as well on a conversation that we had yesterday about an innovative rehab program in the Texas prison system that has reportedly reduced incarceration rates there for the first time since the 80s.
This is Chris from Oklahoma. Originally, I am from Texas. I think the very idea of making the Texas prison system the model for the nation is a very, very scary thought, since Texas prisons are a privatized system, which means that a private group of shareholders profits personally from increased crime and higher prison population. because I think it's a very scary thought to think that might be going nationwide.
Although that makes the point that then it's even more interesting that they're investing in a program that reduces
that
incarceration
reduced
rates.
Yeah.
It's actually against their own business model.
That's right.
We didn't even get into that.
One more story that's got you talking, certainly not the least. We have more female veterans returning from war, and so the traditionally male-dominated VA is now starting to respond to this new crop of patients.
This is Alexa from the ACLU. It's great that you're shining a light on issues women veterans face, but many of these problems start before servicewomen come home. We've heard from servicewomen that they lack a range of reproductive health services, including abortion and contraception. At a time when we are asking so much of our servicewomen, it is critical that we meet the full range of their health care needs.
Well, the story itself, the issue, deserves more attention, and we will keep following it. Thanks to you, Alexa, and everyone else who's been weighing in. If you have something to say about any story you hear, give us a ring at 877-8 My Take or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
No, I mean, the Veterans Administration, the Pentagon playing catch up on a lot of these medical issues, and the biggest of all is the fact that this huge population, what was it, a quarter of a million women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, we're asking you to talk about student loans as well and whether you actually read the fine print when you were a freshman and took out one of those student loans. Sarah emailed us at thetakeaway.org. I have $75,000 in student loan debt, and that's just for my bachelor's. I went to a great engineering school and have a great job thanks to it, but sometimes I wonder if it was worth it. I refer to my monthly payments as my apartment I'll never get to see or live in.
Oh,
that's actually a brilliant story. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Coming up, natural gas is a cleaner fossil fuel than coal and oil. But what happens when the industry starts getting bought out by oil companies? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, is natural gas the big play in green energy? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made this announcement at the climate talks in Copenhagen this morning.
The United States is prepared to work with other countries toward a goal of jointly mobilizing $100 billion a year by 2020. To address the climate change needs of developing countries.
President Obama leaves for the conference tonight. Citigroup had trouble raising money it needs to repay its bailout to the feds. That means Citigroup is likely to remain under federal control well into next year.
A quick look at the markets. Asian markets and European indices down, as well as Wall Street futures also down. The Dow is going to open at 10,441, the S&P at 1,109, and the NASDAQ will start at 2206. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
This morning, we're going to try to get our head around a big idea at the beginning of the 21st century, looking at the energy business. You may have seen the headline. The Exxon Corporation bought XTO for more than $40 billion, one of the nation's largest producers of natural gas. We're joined and pleased to be joined by Lisa Marganelli, Director of Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation, friend of The Takeaway. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
And Daniel Yergin, of course, chairman of the Cambridge Energy Research Associates and Pulitzer Prize winner for his book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. The new edition of that book is out now. Daniel Yergin, good morning.
And good morning.
You know, I was looking at this huge energy deal where Exxon is taking over this XTO natural gas company. And it seems to me at the beginning of the 21st century, as fossil fuel companies look to the future, there's a trend towards reconsolidation of the industry. It almost looks as though the old Standard Oil at the beginning of the 20th century may be coming back into existence in a new form that includes natural gas, coal, and oil. Daniel Yergin, what do you think?
I don't think that's quite the direction. If you look at the world, big oil is not the United States. It's not these traditional companies. Big oil are the state-owned oil companies from Saudi Aramco to PetroChina to Petróleos de Venezuela, who, when you add them all together, control about 80% of the world's oil reserves. I think what you are getting at, though, is that natural gas is going to loom larger in our energy mix because it's a lower carbon fuel compared to, let's say, coal. And so it is going to be probably pretty important in terms of electric power generation, and I think that's part of what's at work here.
Lisa Marganelli, you heard Daniel Yergin ticking off those big monopoly state-owned oil companies. Is a U.S. company like Exxon at a competitive disadvantage trying to get into the investment for clean fossil fuels in a deal like XTO? Does it need to be more of a monopoly to compete?
I don't think so. XTO has spent years developing the business of natural gas, especially this really hard to get to natural gas, and done all sorts of things to make it more profitable to drill every single well that they do. They've just spent years and years working away on this sort of unprofitable niche, turning it into a profitable niche. And then Exxon basically gets to go in and buy that expertise and buy all of those wells.
Yeah. And, John, Lisa's gone to the essential point. What we've seen in this decade, if you said, what's the most important energy innovation of the decade? It's not wind, it's not solar, it's what Lisa just described, which was this breakthrough that's occurred in liberating this really quite a lot of natural gas that formerly was inaccessible. And I think since this decade only has about 14 days to go, we're pretty safe saying this is the biggest innovation in this decade in terms of energy.
And we're glad to be reporting on it here in the last 14 days of the decade. Let's talk about where natural gas goes from here, because there are extraordinary global competitors in natural gas. Qatar, of course, is the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. There are significant holdings in the United States and in Russia. Where do we look globally for leadership on natural gas production and innovation, like Lisa was talking about? Daniel, you first, and then Lisa.
Well, I think 3 years ago, it would have been, or 2 years ago, it's exactly what you said. You would have looked at Qatar. The other real heavyweight in terms of natural gas is Russia, and the third heavyweight is Iran, although it can't seem to get it together to get its natural gas industry into order. But I think that was the picture, that we would be importing lots and lots of LNG, we'd become more integrated in the global market. And what this innovation now does is says we have the potential for a very significant supply at home, and that as we try and move, and we'll come out of Copenhagen with big targets for reducing CO2, people will be looking to natural gas, particularly not so much for vehicles, but for electric generation.
Right. Lisa Marganelli, you know, the numbers here are huge, $41 or $42 billion, this Exxon deal for XTO. With the president talking about the green industries that are going to burgeon in the next decade or so, it seems to me the numbers that they're using for, you know, installers of solar panels, et cetera, are tiny compared to this change that's going on in the traditional fossil fuel sector. Do you think the old fossil fuel sector actually has some growth potential over the next decade or so?
Well, definitely, but I, what I think is really interesting here is, you know, Exxon has been, for most of this whole decade, the big foot dragger among the oil companies about going to greenhouse gas emissions control. And they've said in the early part of the decade, they said, well, global warming wasn't an issue or it wasn't man-made, and they have really invested quite a lot in that. Now, just in their last report, which came out just last week, they are talking about a carbon price of $30 to $60 a ton. They're talking about natural gas. They're talking about algae. They're talking about basically swinging their whole focus towards making money by reducing carbon from the fuel mix. And that's a really big change. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, we're all waiting for this political solution in Copenhagen. But basically, if we got most of our energy suppliers to sort of change their mindset and say, okay, we're going to try to knock out the carbon and we're going to try to we're instead of resisting greenhouse gas legislation, we're going to push for it. That's a huge change, and that may do quite a bit to push us towards having good legislation,
well,
or legislation at all.
Indeed, it is a huge change. But I can already, Daniel Juergen, read the emails from Takeaway listeners who are going to say, John, you get it wrong once again. Natural gas is a carbon fuel. It doesn't reduce really the carbon footprint. It's just sort of tweaking around the edges. What would you say to that?
I think, first of all, you know, when I sat down to do the new edition of the prize, and this follows from what Lisa was saying, I thought, you know, what's really changed? And I think in that period, 2000, when we look back, 2004, 2007, 2008, kind of the world changed its mind, and politically carbon reduction is on the agenda in a way it wasn't half a decade ago. And I think the reality is that the numbers in the energy system are so big. So clearly natural gas is a hydrocarbon, but it's about produces about half as much carbon as coal. And if you're trying to meet targets and you look at the scale of our economy, we hope it will be a $14 trillion economy again. It uses an awful lot of energy, and the answer is going to be you're going to probably have to do everything.
Interesting. All right. Well, then, before we go, are the ghosts of Standard Oil dead then in the 21st century? Yes or no? Daniel Juergen and then Lisa.
I think no. I think if you look at this in a competitive way, there is a lot of competition from those heavyweights outside the U.S.
All right, Lisa Marganelli, is the Standard Oil still haunting us here in the 21st century?
I don't think they're still haunting us, but if what we want in a new low-carbon economy is lots and lots of entrepreneurs and lots of new breakout little industries, we're going to have to push for them just as much as Exxon will be pushing to have its share of the cake.
Thank you, Lisa. Lisa Marganelli is director of the Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation. Oil on the Brain is the title of her book. Daniel Juergen is the author of the book The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. An updated edition is out now. We talk tech every Thursday, and we tell you how to build a better online password. Your pet's name doesn't cut it. We'll give you some strategies. That's in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Turns out dying men do tell tales. An elephant handler at Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus named Sammy Haddock has died. And the reason that's important is because he made a promise to his dying wife 3 years ago. He left behind a notarized statement detailing abuse that elephants faced at the hands of trainers and handlers at Ringling Brothers. David Montgomery reported on this story for the Washington Post. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Celeste.
What abuse did Sammy Haddock allege is going on at the Ringling Brothers training camps?
Well, he was speaking about how baby elephants, we're talking ages 18 months to 2 years, are trained at a special conservation center that Ringling has in Central Florida. And he objected, after having participated in it many years, to the use of bull hooks and ropes. Bull hooks are pointed sticks, which are used to help train the elephants, and ropes, which are used to sort of force them into positions so that they can learn behaviors that later on, when they get bigger and go on the road with the circus, they'll be able to entertain audiences.
Was there any corroboration for this story?
Yes, Ringling Brothers, that's what's so fascinating about this. Ringling Brothers says the photographs are genuine. Sammy Haddock left behind 70 photographs of his workplace that showed the training of elephants. Ringling Brothers said, absolutely, these are genuine photos of training of elephants. Where they depart, though, is Ringling says this is professional, humane, legal, and perfectly justifiable elephant training. And PETA, the animal rights organization, which is bringing this to light, has the opposite interpretation. And PETA is banking on the public when they see these photos, the public being shocked at these cute little creatures with ropes on them and bull hooks sort of in their vicinity.
The public may be shocked, but actually, having seen some of the photos, that's actually legal according to the American Zoo Association as well.
Absolutely. The bull hooks are an approved tool. They're called guides in the zoo industry and the circus industry, and Ringling Brothers says they're only used as a light cue, a little tap to tell the baby elephant, you know, raise your foot, and they give it an apple, and they say foot, they touch it with the bull hook, and they give a treat, and they say that's how training is done.
Okay, we have a statement responding to this from Ringling Brothers. They say, I am downright saddened and perplexed that Sammy would find any reason to do this. In all the time he worked here, he never once raised any concerns about the treatment of animals. Although he worked for us, he was not an upper handler, therefore was not trained to do so. Our handlers are extensively trained. I've been here a long time and love my job. I would never stand for the harming of any animal. We have a no-tolerance policy on cruelty to animals, and if someone is found to be abusing an animal, they are immediately dismissed. So obviously, Sammy Haddock knew what he was doing when he sent this on to PETA. Where do you expect these allegations to go from here?
Well, PETA has very recently taken Sammy's statement and his photographs to the U.S. Department of Agriculture and filed a formal complaint with the USDA, and they are ultimately hoping that the USDA will say that this is a violation of the Animal Welfare Act. And PETA's end game is they hope that all animals are out of the circus. Ringling Brothers says that's not going to happen, and that will be the USDA is going to arbitrate that.
This is touchy, David, because if they make that decision, that would have effects also on how elephants are treated in our zoos across the country. David Montgomery is a reporter for the Style section at the Washington Post. He joined us from his office in D.C.
It's so sad. This Sammy Haddock. I mean, did he believe every day that he was being cruel, or is he just angry at his employers?
I don't know. It's a puzzle. It's really strange.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. It turns out if you have proliferating digital passwords in this age, there's a tool to actually manage them. Trouble is you need a password for it. One of the issues we're going to deal with in dealing with changing passwords in our tech segment in just a minute or so. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Economic news out just now. Jobless claims unexpectedly rising to 480,000 new claims last week, signaling continued weakness in the labor market. In Copenhagen, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced this morning the U.S. is prepared to join with other wealthy countries to raise $100 billion in climate aid for poor countries.
Back home, Citigroup says it's suspending foreclosures and evictions for 30 days. The holiday reprieve should help around 2,000 homeowners with scheduled foreclosure sales, and another 2,000 are due to receive foreclosure notices. And American Airlines and Delta are in the midst of a hot bidding war over Japan Airlines. So why has Japan Airlines become such a hot commodity? Well, the answer to that question, we have Mickey Maynard, business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Mickey.
Good morning, Celeste.
Why do both American and Delta want Japan Airlines so badly?
Well, there's a new treaty between the United States and Japan, and, you know, for years there have only been a couple of airlines, United and Northwest, which is now owned by Delta, which had the right to fly to Japan, to fly anywhere they wanted in Japan. Now we have a new treaty. Now it's going to open up, and suddenly Japan Airlines becomes a very attractive partner.
Okay, well, we also got news this week that they're expecting the airlines globally to lose $5.6 billion in 2010. Is this going to help the American Airlines and Delta stay in the black?
Well, actually, even though they expect losses, the global air market is starting to pick up, and people think that Asia will pick up first. And so any place you can fly in Asia suddenly becomes attractive, even though JAL, which is what people call Japan Airlines, is going to need a big overhaul. American's been through a restructuring. Delta's been through bankruptcy, and they're both arguing that they're the company that can fix Japan Airlines, and then in return they get to fly into Japan.
One last question for you. I mean, airline tickets to Japan have been notoriously high for a long time. Is this going to bring the price down?
This is supposed to bring the price down, more competition, and that's always good for travelers.
Okay, Mickey Maynard, business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
So on Thursday, technology, not so much about gizmos this week, but something more about the idea of passwords and how they have really changed in our era. We need passwords in every aspect of our digital lives nowadays. It's a bad comedy sometimes trying to communicate with your own digital device.
Who are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Who are you?
I'm fine, too, but you can't come in unless you give the password.
Oh, what is the password?
Oh, no, you gotta tell me. It's the name of a fish.
Okay, the Marx Brothers is actually good comedy, but if you don't have the password, there's always that backup security question to help you out.
What is your name?
Sir Galahad of Camelot.
What is your quest?
I seek the Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue. No.
All right, so Monty Python seeks the Holy Grail, and tech designers seek the perfect security system. The rest of us seek a perfect password in a time when we have to have more and more of them. Baratunde Thurston, Takeaway contributor and our tech guide here on Thursdays. How many passwords do you have?
I have at least 783 passwords.
783?
You've counted them?
I have software that manages them and has counted them.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So there is a tension, though, between coming up with a password that's kind of familiar to you and relates to, like, you know, the name of your kids or something like that,
right,
and the tension of making a password that's random enough to be unhackable. How do you resolve those tensions?
Well, I think first you start with the idea that there is no one password to rule them all. This is not like the magical ring that will unlock everything in your life, because that's too vulnerable. A single point of failure opens up your life to anybody who happens to get that.
Instead, so people with single passwords
are making
stupid,
a big mistake.
Stupid
Even
people.
If it's a really good password, having just one is not enough. The fun part is trying to create a puzzle out of it. So it can be familiar to you, but it shouldn't sound familiar. It shouldn't be an English word. So even if you pick, say, a Disney character like Goofy, you might want to make a sentence out of it and use the acronym
all right,
of that
let's
sentence.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Okay, I'm going to make a password out of Goofy.
Yes.
All right. Goofy. Do I have to put like a character in there? Goofy question mark?
You can say like Goofy is my favorite dog, right? G-I-F-D, I think. But then you want to add maybe a number in the middle of that, capitalize a letter, and maybe one other thing depending on the site you're using it to unlock, for example.
We're supposed to remember that?
Well, for the more secure, the more valuable the information is you're trying to protect, the more difficult it is. If you're logging into the New York Times or your you know, something that is like a media consumption cue online, that's not that important if someone breaks into that. But if it's your bank, you want it to be kind of tough.
You know, I've heard these warnings about good passwords for years, and I never really paid any attention. But, you know, I kept my photos online with Snapfish for a very long time, okay. Like the first 7 years of my son's life. All the pictures are there. And I had very stupidly opened this account using my work email. Which I obviously cannot access anymore. I don't work at that place anymore. Yeah. I don't remember the password. I can't reset it.
So you've lost
I've lost
Grant's pictures?
6 or 7 years of pictures.
And how old is your...
He's now 11.
So he's going to be old enough soon to be mad at you about this.
Among the many things he's mad at me about.
Pass that, Baratunde. Well, so, you know, Bill Gates famously said, maybe as long as a decade ago, that the whole idea of passwords as an encryption system for security is dead. And there are a lot of security experts who say this is just over with, the whole password idea. Is there any point to these new strategies? Should we just be moving on?
Well, I don't think the actual individual citizen or consumer has a choice to just move on. They're what we have to work with. Ideally, you use some combination of biometrics, you know, a fingerprint, an eye scan, a breathalyzer. Maybe we all have unique, you know, fingerprints in our breath prints, if you will. But we're not in that world just yet. So we have to contend with the technology that's available.
So let's talk about your password manager software, okay? Now, that kind of scares me, because if somebody hacks into the password management software, then you're really, really dead. Well, but you're secure enough, you're confident enough to actually use this.
I am, and I once again, you know, there are some things that don't go in there. But I think it's important to back up, first of all, you know, all of your information, your digital and kind of conceptual information, so know what's in your wallet, you know, if you happen to lose that. In terms of the password management software on the PC side, there's KeePassX, KeePassX, it's cross-platform. On the Mac side, there's 1Password, number 1Password. And those are really highly encrypted systems, so someone using brute force won't be able to just open it. They automatically lock, and you want to make sure that password is super secure.
And let me just get this straight. We are in the 21st century. Yeah. To get into your password management system, you need a...
Password. See, it's kind of meta now. Right. It's like passwords within passwords within passwords.
Yeah. All right, here's a trick that Farhad Manju, who's sometimes on this program, suggested, and I want you to sort of track this for us.
Sure.
Start with an original but memorable phrase that you can remember, something that your life references. Okay, so make it relevant to your life. My first car was a lemon, he says, or my first cat was a lemon. Then you can change it. And then you turn it into an acronym, which is sort of what you were talking about with Goofy.
Right.
And in that case, my first car was a lemon. It would be M1STCWL. Then your security question can be, what was your first car? And then you go, oh, right, my first car was a lemon. Then you do the process.
That's smart.
Yeah.
Now, the problem, of course, is we've basically given a strategy for hackers to reverse engineer every Takeaway listener's password,
well,
right?
Well, no, not exactly, because each person would come up with a unique one. I interned when I was in high school at NIH, and the technology person there gave me a visual cue. So you start with the word that's related to the site you're trying to log into, maybe capitalize a letter, and then you create a visual pattern. Maybe it's two steps to the left and one to the right. Maybe it's a diamond. Maybe it's a square. But you have something that only you are going to come up with in combination with the word that's going to unlock it.
But how do you remember which one goes with which site?
Well, no, I asked this yesterday on Twitter, and someone had a really good one. They used the first three letters of the site name. So if they're going into Amazon, there's AMA. That's kind of like the unlock key there. That's the seed. If they're at Google, it's GOO. If it's at Bank of America, it's BAN. So you start to do this enough, you remember it. We have great ability in our minds to recognize and remember patterns, and we can use that.
Visual patterns. No, that's true. That is true. Yeah. Neurologically, we are better at memorizing visual things, so that visual idea that you got at NIH is a pretty good one.
It's been useful for me so far, and my visual pattern is going to be different from yours.
All right. Well, you know, interact with Baratunde Thurston on this question of password strategy if you like. You know how to reach us at thetakeaway.org. 877-8-MY-TAKE with your password stories, or mytake at thetakeaway.org with your suggestions. What?
Don't call us with your password.
Don't call us with your password. Actually, go ahead.
You can call
especially
me
if you're Ken Lewis of Bank of America. Baratunde Thurston, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
From Hollywood, the word game of the stars, passwords.
And we have a listener responding already.
My name is Aaron. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm a musician, and I use a rhythm on the keyboard to come up with my passwords. I pick a rhythm, and then I can just change what letters or characters I use based on how often the site asks you to change it, but the rhythm always remains the same.
close encounter with one of our listeners. You can have a close encounter with us at 8778-MY-TAKE.
That's also how you can reach us to tell us your stories about student loans. Our series Life in Fine Print continues today with a look at those loans and how they can balloon once you leave school. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. My password is This is the Takeaway.
In Copenhagen, it's getting down to decision day. See what you're
gonna do. The fact is that we are moving in the United States in a way that we have not moved over the course of the last 10 years. We're beginning to make up for lost time.
There may not be much time left to reach a climate change agreement in Copenhagen. As leaders get down to real business, the issues get tougher, the divisions clearer. What
you gonna do? Bringing so many leaders together, representing so much political commitment, should make it doable.
A hot world looks to Copenhagen for some cool. We'll dance on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, December 17th, and The Takeaway is whether the presence of heads of state moves this Copenhagen climate change meeting along or just stalls it more.
Or having them there does nothing except more press conferences.
We're going to find out.
But let's get right to it. The final push is on to reach a deal at the climate talks in Copenhagen. This morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced that the United States is prepared to join other rich countries in raising $100 billion for poor countries. That addresses a key sticking point between the disparate sides. The negotiations will also get another joint when President Obama joins them at the conference tonight.
Well, Peter Thompson joins us. He's an environmental editor for PRI's The World. He's in Copenhagen. So Obama arrives. Peter, where do we stand with these negotiations?
The chief of the whole negotiating process, Ivo de Boer of the UN, said that the cable car is moving again after having been stalled for much of the week. So it looks like the ministers and the heads of state may actually be moving things forward.
And is a cable car an environmentally friendly metaphor, or what's the carbon footprint of that?
Well, it's certainly more environmentally friendly than a Hummer.
Well, we'll talk about the details in just a moment. But when you say moving forward, is that on a comprehensive agreement or something more along the lines of this pay poor countries to preserve their forests?
Well, they're saying a comprehensive agreement. Now,
All right.
Of course, that's still going to be full of holes.
All right. Peter Thompson, stay with us. We'll be back to you in just a moment to explore those details. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
New economic numbers out in the past half hour. Jobless claims unexpectedly rose to 480,000. That's up 7,000 from last week and worse than economists had expected. Later this morning, the White House will announce a $182 million plan to build high-speed internet networks in 18 rural areas across the country. Heading overseas, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says the focus U.S. troops should be on the people of Afghanistan. Admiral Mike Mullen says major population areas must be protected and Afghans must be allowed to move around freely. Mullen is visiting troops in the front lines in Kandahar.
There may be political trouble brewing across the border in Pakistan. The country's top court struck down an amnesty that had protected the president of Pakistan from corruption charges. Pakistan's president is a key U.S. ally. Meanwhile, our partner, The New York Times, is reporting that American diplomats in Pakistan are facing harassment from parts of the Pakistani military and intelligence community, having their cars searched and visa requests turned down. Earlier on the program, we spoke to Shuja Nawaz, president director of the South Asia program at the Atlantic Council.
My fear is that if both sides are not careful with their rhetoric, this may be a train wreck in the making.
Back in the U.S., 2 weeks before Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis is set to retire, the bank has named someone named Brian Moynihan as its new chief executive. Meanwhile, Citigroup struggled yesterday to raise the money it needs to repay its bailout. That means Citigroup is likely to remain under federal control well into next year. The markets are reacting to all that news, including the jobs report out this morning. Asian markets down, European indices down, Wall Street futures down, way down, actually, since the jobs figure came out. The Dow will open at 10,441. The S&P gets underway at 1,109, and the NASDAQ opens at 2206.
What's the cost of higher education? It could be twice as much as it was when you left college. Our series Life in Fine Print is going to take a look at student loans today and the ballooning debt associated with them. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, more from Copenhagen and what the world leaders can actually accomplish.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
In a sense, the ups and downs in Copenhagen may be something really, really positive. An indication that the globe, that world leaders, that institutions around the world are actually grappling with climate change, unlike what happened in Kyoto 10 years.
Argument.
Possibly. Well, we'll start with an optimistic look. Peter Thompson rejoins us now, environment editor for PRI's The World. He's in Copenhagen, where he said just moments ago that the cable car is moving again on a possible comprehensive deal. J.P. Lias also joins us from the Wilderness Society. He's climate change policy advisor there. He's in Washington. But Peter Thompson, let's talk about the outlines of a comprehensive deal. And do you buy my argument that part of the challenges here and the disagreements are signs that they are taking this very, very seriously?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that there's any question that anybody is not taking this very, very seriously. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that things have been so chaotic this week, is that the stakes are incredibly high. These meetings are always chaotic. They're held almost every 2 years. The last one I covered was the Earth Summit, the original of these meetings back in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. That was chaotic, and that seems like a sandbox now looking back. But the fact is that the world has promised a lot here, and the need is becoming clearer every day as the science becomes clearer and clearer, and what is happening, what we're doing to the atmospheric climate system. And so I think that everybody actually does take this extremely seriously, but there are huge disagreements still.
J.P. Lias, as the science, as Peter Thompson says, becomes clearer and clearer, and there is a debate about that, nevertheless, the idea of what are the institutions that can actually manage a climate change policy that is global in scope, that becomes less and less clear. Where does that stand right now?
Well, that's a great question. I would just like to put a fine point on that. Quite honestly, I think it's time that we move beyond any talk of a debate in the science, because quite honestly, that's been put to bed, and, the tired tricks, of polluting companies, have really, come to fail. And, we're seeing that in Copenhagen more and more. In terms of, who's going to deal with this, that is the question. And what we're hoping is going to come out of Copenhagen is, some sort of framework. Obviously, we're not probably going to get everything nailed down, and some things are going to be moved down the line to Mexico City, which is the next time delegates will get together and kind of, put pen to ink and hopefully cross T's and dot I's on what was discussed here. But I think a lot of the issues that we've been seeing over the past week or so, especially in the verification of emissions, is exactly that. Who's going to be doing this work, and who's going to be making sure that it's done well? I think in the next few days, it seems, at least from what I'm hearing late last night, that China and the U.S. did come to maybe a better understanding of what each country was asking of the other. But there's still a lot of work to be done. On the other side, on the deforestation, your question rings true there as well of who's going to be doing the work of making sure that we reduce deforestation and land degradation, and how do you measure success in that? Because we're talking about a lot of money being spent in a lot of places. The framework that's created here and how it's implemented in the ground in years ahead is going to be absolutely critical to make sure that we get the climate success we need.
Well, JP, you say that the scientific debate is pretty much settled, but that's not entirely true. Maybe the scientific debate is mostly on one side in terms of the fact that global warming could exist, but the ideas about how the most effective or best way to combat global warming, that jury's still out. And maybe the reason that it's so difficult to come to a comprehensive agreement on this is that it could all change. In 3 to 4 years, the scientists could come back and say, hey, forests aren't the best way to combat global warming.
Well, you raise a good point in terms of certainly the scientific process with anything is going to improve as, we learn more and learn upon mistakes and whatnot and kind of improve upon past practices. And, I think you framed the question very well in that I think we're moving beyond is it happening, is it not happening, are emissions the problem or not? And rather, the real question in the debate that we really need to have is just that, what do we do about it?
Right.
And we know, regardless of, how much forests may emit, is it 17%, is it 21%, preserving and protecting forests is a no-regrets policy.
Right, although there will be policy implications, and hammering out those details is exactly what they're doing. Peter Thompson, awaiting Barack Obama's arrival in Copenhagen, is this going to have an impact? I mean, we've been told all week long that leaders don't want to go home empty-handed, but I suspect there are some leaders who maybe would prefer to go home empty-handed out of these climate talks, Peter Thompson.
Well, I haven't heard of any leaders who do want to go home empty-handed, although some people, you know, are saying that no deal is better than a bad deal. But there's always brinksmanship at things like this. You know, Obama already came to Copenhagen and went home empty-handed once this year on the Olympics. And this is right. So much of a bigger game that he, I'm certain, does not want to go home empty-handed. Now, you know, we have been told unofficially that he's not going to be offering any grand new proposals, certainly on emissions targets. But that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of wiggle room on other things. And Secretary Clinton's announcement today that the U.S. would marshal this $100 billion per year mitigation and adaptation fund for the world's poorest countries starting by 2020 is a very substantial offer. And people are saying here that it really puts pressure on the Chinese, because this money is going to be targeted at the least developed countries. The least developed countries are going to pressure, but it's contingent on China moving on the issue of verification and verifying their emissions. And so people are saying that the U.S. offer is going to pressure the least developed countries to in turn pressure China to move off of their hard stance on verification, right, so that they can get this money. And the money is crucial. It's a huge piece of this puzzle.
But managing it is also a puzzle. I mean, we got a huge conversation here. It's great to have J.P. Lias from the Wilderness Society, a climate change policy advisor for that organization. But also, Peter Thompson, you're an expert, environment editor for PRI's The World. And I have to ask you, and this is sort of our final question here, you know, we've already seen the whole World Trade Organization international enforcement mechanisms for all these trade issues that proliferated in the last decade come to a grinding halt. How do people preserve optimism on something even more challenging like climate change, having the ability to come up with institutions to make this work, Peter?
Well, I mean, that of course, always is the huge question. And I'm not sure that anybody is optimistic that we can work out all, that we, the world, can work out all these details here or next year in Mexico or even in the next few years, that it's a long process. It's going to be trial and error to some degree. But this is the most important challenge that the global community has ever tried to face together, also the most complex.
Let me just do a list for you, Peter, and tell me if I'm right or wrong. Is it likely best case scenario here is we're going to have some sort of compensation outline of an agreement, we'll have a comprehensive agreement to look forward on targets, and that the U.S. and the Chinese may resolve their differences? Is that best case scenario here?
Best case scenario, that there will be some meeting of the minds between the U.S. and China, and they are the two biggest players. They have between them the world's more than half the world's emissions.
That's a great takeaway. Barack Obama arrives at those climate change talks in Copenhagen later today. Peter Thompson, environment editor for PRI's The World, is in Copenhagen. Also joining us from Washington was J.P. Lias, climate change policy advisor with the Wilderness Society. And now, at 15 minutes past the hour, let's look at the headlines.
The number of newly laid off workers filing claims for unemployment benefits unexpectedly rose last week. The Labor Department says the number of new jobless claims rose to 480,000. That's up 7,000 from the previous week. Abroad, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, is visiting U.S. troops in Afghanistan. He said U.S. forces should, quote, focus on the people of Afghanistan. He also said heavily populated areas must be protected.
But they won't be protected with Russian hardware. NATO has failed to gain any commitment from Russia to offer more help in Afghanistan. NATO had asked Russia to provide helicopters and to train the Afghan Air Force. One of the most wanted figures in Mexico, Mexico's drug war, was killed in a shootout with the Navy last night. Officials say Arturo Beltran Leia's cartel was responsible for distributing tons of cocaine in the United States. Finally, tributes are being paid to Walt Disney's nephew, Roy Disney. He died yesterday at the age of 79, credited with helping create Disney blockbusters like Beauty and the Beast and The Little Mermaid.
How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you think. Sure. She's got everything.
We just made our producer, Leo, very happy. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, a new CEO at Bank of America. We're going to talk about what Brian Moynihan can do for the finance company and how the government's involved in picking him in just a few minutes.
I think Roy Disney may be the last Disney at the company. Maybe.
That could be true.
Hey, you want that to go?
And your news takeouts this morning come in part from Louise Story, Takeaway Finance contributor, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, both in the studio. And it's a blue plate special for you this morning, Louise. Three big business stories. We got the FTC with a huge ruling, a complaint against Intel Corporation for monopolistic practices alleged. You've got Bank of America having trouble naming a new CEO, and the idea of government involvement in the ability of banks to attract executives is possibly going on there. And Citibank all giddy at the beginning of the week saying we're going to raise money and get out from underneath the bank bailout. Turns out they couldn't raise the money. Which do you want to tackle first?
It is a big business day. Let's start with Bank of America. You know, we've been on that one for months. They've been looking for a new CEO. This came down in some ways to who they couldn't hire rather than who they could. They named Brian Moynihan. He's an executive who's been there since their Fleet acquisition. But I wrote today in the New York Times about documents that have come from the Attorney General of New York, which basically ruled out another candidate, Greg Krill. They wanted to name this guy. He's their chief risk officer, but it looks like he's being implicated in the investigation over the Merrill Lynch merger. Wow. So he was ruled out. So finally, they said, okay, we're going to name Brian Moynihan after they were turned down by a lot of other bank execs.
Well, it's just an indication of how these banks that are under the TARP or were under the TARP are under the scrutiny of federal and
state authorities. They're under a lot of scrutiny. Right. And then we look at Citibank, and they're under a lot of pressure as well. They're trying to get out of this bailout. They don't like being under the government thumb. But guess what? They're not so popular in the market. So they tried to raise stock yesterday.
Nobody wanted it.
Well, some people wanted it, but for a low price.
Yeah.
In fact, so low that if the government had started selling its shares like it had said it would do, it would have lost money.
Uh-huh. And Intel says it's shocked and or dismayed and disappointed that the FTC calls it a monopoly or pursuing monopolistic practices in the chip market.
And here we go again, government involvement. Intel is saying that the FTC claim is unfair and that it would hinder its business because the FTC took an extra strong step in looking towards hampering future anti-competitive practices. So that was a big ruling from the FTC about Intel's practices in the chip market.
And possibly a bellwether of where the Obama administration is heading with all of this. Louise Story, Takeaway Finance contributor. That was a lot. Thanks so much.
Our next takeout comes from the intelligence world and the world of cyber wars. Joining us is the Wall Street Journal intelligence correspondent, Siobhan Gorman. It turns out Iraqi militants are using a $26 off-the-shelf software to intercept live video feeds from U.S. Predator drones. That's possibly giving them information that they may need to evade U.S. military operations. Siobhan, there's no evidence that the militants have been able to control these drones or reprogram them. So what's the danger here?
Well, the issue is that if you are being watched by the United States because you're a U.S. adversary, it would be very helpful to know when it is that, American military operations are coming your way, and then you can sort of plot your escape. And in addition, the issue that we wrote about had to do with Iranian-backed militants in Iraq. And one of the things that the U.S. uses Predator drones for is to monitor the operations that ship weaponry over the border from Iran to Iraq. And so, monitoring basic operations is helpful, particularly if you don't want your operations disrupted.
You reported that the United States has actually known about this flaw where their video feeds from the plane, the drone, to the ground is unencrypted and can be intercepted. They've known about that since the campaign in Bosnia in the 1990s. So why haven't they fixed it yet?
Well, the best answer I got, I had that very same question myself, and the best answer I got was that the U.S. didn't think that other adversaries would be able to intercept the video feeds. Huh. It was 1990s technology, and in the 1990s, we didn't have the kinds of software that's available now that will now allow you to intercept those feeds.
So this is clearly a sign that the cyber portion of this war is getting more sophisticated. Right?
Indeed, and it also shows that even if you have only moderately sophisticated adversaries in a particular battle, they can team up with people who are more sophisticated. I mean, if the theory that these are Iranian-backed militants is true, I mean, Iran is definitely one of the more technologically sophisticated adversaries that the U.S. has.
Just a quick question about the software itself. This software was not intended for this type of behavior, right? It was intended for music?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of like the satellite version of Napster or something. You could, the idea was that you could pirate movies or music or other types of things that people can pull down from satellites. And so this is a Russian software company that built this.
it's sort of Tetris. You know, it gets us in trouble once again. Siobhan, on issues of countermeasures, is the Pentagon saying that to actually do an encryption of real-time download video software would actually impede the ability of controllers to operate those drones in some sense?
Well, some former officials made the argument when asked why it hadn't been done. They said, well, it could add weight to the plane, and it would be more expensive, and it could at least it could slow the process of rolling these drones off the assembly line. And so with the press of war, the idea was, you know, it's not that big a risk. We can take it. So now they are going back, and they're encrypting those communications. So they've decided that it's a high enough priority to do that.
Finally decided to do that. Okay, Siobhan Gorman, Wall Street Journal intelligence correspondent, talking about militants using extremely inexpensive software to intercept live video feeds from the U.S. Predator drones. A little later, we're going to be talking about student loans. And one of our listeners emailed us saying, I went back to school to get an undergraduate degree at age 39. Chalk it up to the human spirit. I'm now about to turn 57 years old, and a year ago was forced to declare bankruptcy. My non-dischargeable student loan debt to the Department of Education is about to hit $73,000. Even gambling debts are dischargeable under bankruptcy law, but not students' loan. The D of E owns me. That's from Gary. And an interesting story. We want to get all of your stories about student loans. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's right. Did you read the fine print that you cannot get rid of these loans no matter what?
I know it now.
Coming up, arguably one of the most successful government-run programs is about to get cut under the new health care bill, and it's a program that protects children. We're going to talk about S-CHIP in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. Hopes for a deal at the climate talks in Copenhagen are fading. World leaders now say the conference may end without a comprehensive deal. In an effort to inject new life into the negotiations this morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. will join others in raising $100 billion a year to help developing nations cope with global warming.
The important point for the next 2 days is not to talk about how we would fund money that we haven't yet agreed to fund, but to make the agreement that that is what we're going to do.
Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Peter Thompson of PRI's The World, who's in Copenhagen, says the attention now shifts to China.
People are saying here that it really puts pressure on the Chinese because this money is going to be targeted at the least developed countries, but it's contingent on China moving on the issue of verification and verifying their emissions.
President Obama heads to the conference tonight for the final day of negotiations. News out of Pakistan this hour. Intelligence officers there say a suspected U.S. strike involving multiple drones killed at least 15 people. We'll have more information as it becomes available.
New economic numbers out in the last hour. Jobless claims unexpectedly rose to 480,000, up 7,000 from last week's claims. And a lukewarm response to massive stock offerings by Citigroup has led the Treasury Department to temporarily back out of plans to sell its share in the bank. That means Citigroup is likely to remain under federal control well into next year. And all of that is moving the markets this morning. Wall Street is open, and the Dow is down about 0.5%, a little more than 0.5% at this point. The S&P is off 7 points. The NASDAQ is off 14.60. Also, the fact that the dollar is unwinding, the shorts are in the market on the dollar, that's also having an impact on the market. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The S-CHIP program started back in the late 90s. It's the State Children's Health Insurance Program, and it's been popular not just among kids and their parents, but among pediatricians and hospitals and healthcare providers for a very long time. That program could face some serious changes as the House plans to repeal it in the new healthcare bill. We're joined now by Marion Wright Edelman. She's the president of the Children's Defense Fund and an advocate for disadvantaged Americans. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Many people probably don't know what S-CHIP is. Could you explain exactly what this program does?
Yes, I can. It's the State Children's Health Insurance Program, and it serves working and moderate income families who are earn too much to apply for Medicaid or be eligible for Medicaid, but who could not get insurance. And millions of children have been helped, and it provides health benefits for about 7 million now, and we would expect it to add more. But President Obama signed it with much fanfare because it's a very popular and cost-effective program and successful program in February. But then the House turned around a few months later in their bill to abolish it. And we're now struggling today and tomorrow in the Senate to extend the state children's health insurance program until 2019 to improve it, building on best practices, until we can see what this new exchange, because they would turn all the CHIP children over, millions of them, into this new untested, more costly exchange without cost sharing and cost benefit protections. And we know that parents will end up having to pay more for less. And so we want to keep CHIP until we can see that this new proposed exchange in national health insurance is safe and is going to be better than this currently successful, cost-effective program for working and moderate income families.
Okay. A lot of healthcare providers point to SCHIP as an extremely effective program in making sure that children are covered with comprehensive insurance. The big weakness I see with SCHIP is that it constantly has to be reauthorized. Every so often we go through this fight in Congress and we have to make sure that on both sides of the aisle people are going to vote for it and it doesn't get weakened and then that the president signs it. So isn't it a good thing to start talking about a way to find a permanent replacement for SCHIP, something that does not have to be reauthorized every once in a while?
It would be good, but Senator Casey is proposing to, at the moment, in an amendment, and that's what we want in the Senate bill, is to make it mandatory in every state for children, to make it so that it provides the same comprehensive benefits as Medicaid, to make it simple. And so the Casey amendment, which we hope that Majority Leader Reid will include, would take away that discretion of states in that way. It would make sure that every child, wherever they live, would be guaranteed care, comprehensive care under this successful program, and then we'll see whether whatever is offered in this exchange in 2019 is going to be better. But the Casey amendments would do what we want to have done, and that's what the Senate should do, that's what the House should do, and millions of children should not be left worse off rather than better off, and the Casey amendment would help that be accomplished.
All right, Marian Wright Edelman, it's always great to have you on the program, President of the Children's Defense Fund. Let's get into that wait-and-see issue that you raised both in Celeste's first question and right there. Would you favor, then, a set of legislative triggers that basically we go into a health care reform package with the exchange program in place, but if certain triggers aren't met, that we would revert back to SCHIP and that sort of strategy?
Well, I just want to keep SCHIP until we see how the exchange works. And Senator Rockefeller put in an amendment, and the Casey amendment would do the same, to keep CHIP until 2019. In 2016, you would have a study to see how this exchange is working, to see whether it's going to be better than CHIP, to see if it's going to be a safe place and provide more cost-effective benefits for children. And then we will determine in 2016 whether in 2019. But right now, under the House bill, they would end on 2013, go into this thing that is untested on 2014. And so we want to delay this. Look at it, have the Secretary of Health and Education study the exchange. We'll have experience with it. And then we can determine whether an improved and extended CHIP program is going to be better than the exchange or whether the exchange may be working effectively. So we don't want precipitous action. We want to build on what works and that can be made better. And I think that that is what we hope that the Senate and the final health reform bill would do, because otherwise it is our estimate that millions of children who are now in CHIP are going to end up worse off rather than better off, and that would be a tragedy under national health reform.
One of the concerns of your organization is you're afraid that if these kids get rolled under the exchange, that if the parents are low on cash, don't have a lot of disposable income, and are shopping the exchange, they're going to choose a low-cost insurance to pay more out of pocket. They're going to have something that doesn't have a lot of benefits and doesn't cover enough. Is that the concern?
That's one of the concerns, but the bigger concern is that there is no protection for parents. There's going to be high insurance companies, and this is going to be driven largely by insurance companies, don't have the same kind of limits on what they can charge parents on premiums and in copays. And we know when you increase copays, and it's very clear from the actuarial studies that have now been done, that it will be far more costly, and you'll require parents to pay more, and that means that fewer children will be insured. And so what we don't want is to take people out of a program like CHIP, where you have a maximum of less than 2% of what they can be charged, and put them into something where they could be made to pay 3, 4, 5, 20 times more, because there are no limits on what the insurance companies could charge parents.
So basically, with this issue, it's crucial that the government be the one that controls what's covered and what's not, rather than leaving this up to the vagaries of the market and to what parents can afford?
When it comes to children and parents at the moment, and when you have millions of children who are uninsured and working families. We must not break and destroy something that works, that is cost-effective, and move them into something we don't know how it's going to work without any protections or for children and for families. Let's wait and see. Children need to be protected. We protect through Medicare our seniors. Children need the same kind of health safety net, but don't take away something that works to put it into something that we don't know will work and that may not be as effective and will cost more and will result in fewer children getting insurance.
Marion Wright Edelman, president of the Children's Defense Fund, thanks. Coming up, the cost of higher education. For some, it's as twice as much as you might think, or maybe it's twice as much as when they left college. Our series Life in Fine Print continues later this hour with a look at students' loans. What's your story? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. John, have you paid off your student loans?
Oh, long, long, long time ago.
I haven't.
Long, long time ago. I lucked out, actually. I actually got a really good job in my early 20s and was able to pay them off very early on. I know.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry, and I feel like Richard Attenborough on the program Nature, looking at the strange customs of the people in the United Kingdom. Chris Hawkins, are you still there? You haven't hung up yet, have you?
Nearly.
No, nearly, yes, there you go.
That sounded more like me than me.
Chris Hawkins is a DJ for BBC Six Music, talking about something that happens only in the UK, on the charts in the UK, involving Simon Cowell, a program called The X Factor, and pop music. First of all, tell me what The X Factor is and why the charts in Britain are all a flurry over the question of what's going to be the top song in Britain for the Christmas season.
The X Factor is essentially a talent show run by Simon Cowell where thousands and thousands of contestants compete to win the title of The X Factor and then hopefully make it to Christmas number one, which has been the case for the last 4 years. The Christmas number one is always a sought-after spot. There's always interest at this time of year as to who will make number one, and it's been The X Factor, as I say, for the last 4 years, but hopefully not this year.
All right. Well, of course, Simon Cowell, known for American Idol here in the United States, a much huger success story there in UK with lots and lots of reality shows, X Factor being among them. All right. Now, the way that music fans in Britain have tried to get the X Factor to maybe be less influential than it has in the past is they've explicitly called for a competition between two songs. Outline the competition and then let's hear the songs.
Well, essentially, it is X Factor is essentially American Idol. It's much the same. And what's happened this year is that the general public in the UK, I think, are a bit bored. The recession has hit. People have got time on their hands and want to do something to try and sabotage Cowell's grip at the top of the UK charts. So what was done was a Facebook group was set up by a woman called Tracy Mortar, and this has grown and grown and grown, this campaign, to try and get Killing in the Name by Rage Against the Machine to number one ahead of the X Factor song this year.
And the X Factor song this year, and you're sounding a little bit more like David Attenborough there. We're getting into
so
the sort of anthropology of the whole thing.
Exactly.
All right, here's the X Factor song that people wanted to pose. Let's listen to that.
There's always gonna be another mountain. I'm always gonna wanna make it move.
That's X Factor contestant Joe McElderry covering The Climb by Miley Cyrus. That sounds very Simon Cowell. Okay, and here is the Rage Against the Machine challenger. Chris Hawkins, BBC Six music DJ, it would be quite a victory if Rage Against the Machine won here.
It would be amazing. It really would be fantastic. Listen to this. It just sounds so awesome. It's a big tune from the early 90s, and it would be great if a song called Killing in the Name by a brilliant band like Rage Against the Machine could knock off a young boy who did very well. Let's not take anything away from him. He's a very talented guy.
Sure.
He won the X Factor, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, that's really sincere.
You can feel that coming from the heart, can't you? Yeah. A really sickly, sugary song. We've heard them all before, these ballads. It's not even an original song. As you said, it was a Miley Cyrus song already. So let's have something big and different this Christmas.
Chris,
Lady Gaga also in contention.
Chris, are you standing and jumping up and down with your microphone as you're speaking to me now?
I am bouncing. I'm pogoing. I've been playing this song on my radio show, urging all my listeners on BBC Six Music to go out and buy Rage Against the Machine in order to get to number one.
Let's recap. Will Rage Against the Machine depose the X Factor song this year in the UK for the Christmas season? Chris Hawkins says yes. He hopes so anyway. Thanks for being with us, Chris. Chris Hawkins, a DJ on BBC Six Music.
morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. You know, I went to college for music. I didn't get a law degree so I could understand the legal wording in my student loans. And I didn't get a degree in math either in order to be able to do all the formula and quick calculations. We're going to talk about the fine print in student loans in just a few moments. But first,
how's that music working out for you? Sorry, that was mean. It was cruel.
Let's check on headlines at 47 minutes past the hour. President Obama is heading to the Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen later today. That's as world leaders are warning that the summit might end without a comprehensive plan to tackle global warming. Meanwhile, at the conference, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is prepared to help raise $100 billion to help poor countries fight climate change.
Pakistan says at least 15 people have been killed in a U.S. attack near the Afghan borders. The attack involved several U.S. drones, and Israel has announced plans to boost the low number of people prepared to donate their organs. They'll give organ donor preferences to people who are organ donors. Let's check in with our Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick about the Senate battle over health care reform. There's sort of a Christmas passage deadline looming there, Todd, but it's all about procedural delay right now, not so much about the fine print in the bill at this point, right?
It's the fine print of the Senate rules, really, that's governing this process now. You know, John, Democrats really want to pass this bill by Christmas. They think it's important, and they're reading the polls that public support for this bill is eroding, so speed, they believe, is of the essence, and the White House believes it, too. So here's the problem. There are so many procedural hoops to jump through in the Senate, and there are lots and lots that, you know, today's the 17th, Christmas is the 25th. In order to get this bill passed, hopefully by Christmas, you have to jump through so many hoops that Democrats have actually clocked out exactly how long it will take to read this bill and what they've come out best
case
scenario.
Read the entire bill?
Read the bill and then pass the bill and go through all the procedural hoops. The calculus they have now actually comes out to, believe it or not, right around 7 p.m. on December 24th, best case scenario.
And the Republicans are forcing this full readout of the bill, right, as a delaying tactic.
Well, they may do that. We got a whiff of that yesterday. An amendment was introduced by Bernie Sanders on single payer. Nobody ever thought it was going to pass, but Republicans forced the bill to be read in full, and it was going to take 12 hours until the Democrats pulled it off. That was a shot across the bow. Look, we're ready to do this, and they're saying they will pull out all the stops to make sure this bill doesn't pass by Christmas.
Do the senators all know their marching orders?
They all do, but the Republicans don't abide by Harry Reid's marching orders. They don't at all. So if they insist on this bill being read, and some of the procedure, John, we won't get into it, is so arcane that if the Republicans choose to, they can make sure this doesn't pass by Christmas. It only matters how difficult they choose to be.
Well, they've got it scripted possibly down to the wire in case all the delaying tactics are actually pushed ahead. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. I've been wasting.
All this week on The Takeaway, we've been talking about your life in fine print. And today we are going to be talking about a looming lending crisis. In fact, the crisis is already with us. I'm not talking about mortgages. I'm talking about student loans. Recent news just out this week, we found out that more than one in five borrowers of federal student loans, these are the public student loans that come from the government, who attend commercial colleges will default within 3 years of beginning repayment. That's coming out of the Department of Education, and that's alarming. We have with us right now Beth Kobliner, a Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And Beth, I want you to take a listen to this listener.
I'm in debt really badly from a student loan. I made some foolish mistakes, and now I'm paying greatly, greatly for that. I will be paying about double, a little over double what I borrowed. I'll be 69 years old when this loan gets paid off, and right now it's taking a quarter, literally a quarter of my take-home pay every month goes to pay this loan.
That's Wendy in Asheville, North Carolina. And Beth, unfortunately, Wendy is not atypical.
No, you know, I was traveling around the country recently and talking to people, and it was the first time I was hit by the fact that people in their 40s and 50s are still paying back their student loans, and their kids are now going into college or even some graduating into college and grad school. So they have double the amount of loans to pay. People are overwhelmed. The average college student graduates with $23,000 in student debt. Law school students, $100,000, medical students, $160,000. This is really difficult for people, and that's why it's so important to pay attention to the fine print and do whatever you can to reduce those costs. audience.
Okay, there's two levels of fine print here. There's two audiences that we're talking to.
Right.
Number one, we're talking to the people who are going to college now and perhaps opening out a student loan.
Exactly.
And that's a set of fine print where they have to be very careful about what kind of interest rate they're getting and who's issuing that loan, right?
The most important thing for somebody who's applying for a loan right now, going into school, is to get a federal student loan.
A Stafford loan.
Stafford loans are a great place to start. And unfortunately, a lot of banks and private schools, for-profit schools, have lured in people and tried to convince them that they should get these private student loans, which can go as high as 21-22%. And they're more difficult to pay back, they're much more expensive, and there are fewer options when you're paying them back. So it's very important, go to federal student loans. The form you have to fill out is the FAFSA form. It's the free application for federal student aid.
Okay, so that's the first audience that we're speaking to. There's
correct.
A second audience that we speak to, and unfortunately, Linda from Pennsylvania is one of them.
My name's Linda from Pennsylvania. The worst debt I've had in my life is my student loan. When I graduated 20 years ago, it was $10,000. Now it's $30,000 simply because I made some wrong job choices. I got laid off a couple times. I had some financial difficulties. And, you know, you put it in deferment and forbearance, but the interest adds up, and then it goes in default, and they add more collection charges on. The next thing you know, you're just paying enough to cover the interest.
So this is your 50-year-old who still has a student loan.
Right.
Oftentimes, as we've heard from our last two listeners, the debt is larger now than it was when they left college.
It is so frustrating, and it is so overwhelming for people. And the advice I would give is if you currently have student loans, you want to look at exactly what you have and figure out what is the best repayment plan for you. Because you know what? The banks don't make it easy for people. In fact, there's a new program that was introduced, income-based repayment. We have all this on the Takeaway website where we spell out all the different websites, but it's called IBRinfo.org. And they spell out this new payment plan, which actually can save people tens of thousands of dollars if they qualify for typically lower income jobs. But nobody knows about it. It hasn't been publicized at all because the banks lose money
that way. That's the thing we've seen again and again in this whole series, that there's a whole business that's based on assuming that people aren't going to pay attention.
Right.
And so their obligations go through the roof. And if you do begin to pay attention
right.
and get to be vigilant about certain things, the whole business proposition turns
around.
It's
true. And I do this stuff for a living. You know, I had to, you know, to do this story, I looked into what are the options. And it takes a lot of time. And you have to go on these websites and navigate. That's why it's really important, because there's really know where you can go to get that information in a clear way.
Here's the thing that bothers me, Beth. Because I have no problem sharing my own personal information, which is that I still owe $39,000 in student loans.
Right.
That's $9,000 more than when I left graduate school.
Wow.
And here's the thing. Why?
Right.
When we are encouraging people to go back to school, obviously having a college-educated population is a good thing for the country.
Right.
Why are we allowing these student loans to victimize students?
Right. Well, I think one thing about this income-based repayment plan is that it will allow people to pay as a percentage of their income, and after 25 years, the debt disappears totally. And that concept, again, is not being put out there. People don't know about the fact that this exists. Afterwards, we're going to go over your paperwork together, and I'm going to try to help you figure out whether this makes sense for you, because it would be good to know, at least after 25 years of paying back debt, you will be debt-free.
Well, at least I have Beth Koblenzer watching out for me.
Is she going to do that for free for you?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, she's just a nice lady.
Whoa.
Beth Koblenzer is a Takeaway contributor, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s.
You should invoice
tomorrow,
your clients, Beth, if you want to get a financial
the
life.
The last part of our series, hey, don't listen to that
don't
guy.
Don't do free
life
work,
in
Beth.
Fine print. How do you change your behavior to always pay attention to the small type? Maybe it's easier when you've been burned already. Do you have your own story?
My name is Brandon, and I'm from Oklahoma City. Before all this financial stuff hit, I didn't really mind any of the fine print for any of the credit card offers I received. I just wanted to establish some credit. And then once all of this hit, I started to read it, and it turns out that I'm paying, you know, 4 to 5 times more than the balance on the card just to pay off a small amount. So now I'm very aware of this, but the fine print.
that I don't get ripped off.
And that's the basis of the entire series, Life in Fine Print. There it is right there. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE. And Beth is going to come back tomorrow. She's going to have some specific tips on how you can pay more attention to the fine print. It's also going to be on our website, thetakeaway.org.
It's about changing your mindset, becoming more vigilant about a lot of details that allow you to control your life more.
People don't like to read about finances and money, and the fact is you just have to do it.
And it's about energy consumption. It's about all kinds of things. While you're there, catch up on anything you missed by getting our podcast. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry, way down in the fine print here on The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.